Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 7:54 a.m. and that is December 4th. And I'm re-recording the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes because I made some critical errors in calculations. And I was, I think the basis for making these mistakes is that I basically forgot my bond math, that there is a massive difference between stated yields and annualized yields. And the yields in the bond market are annualized. So the calculations that I used for compound interest don't make sense. In fact, they're completely erroneous. That I let myself get carried away with this idea that I developed last week is reprehensible. And I apologize. And I feel deeply ashamed for not taking the time to simply think it through, and particularly the logical inconsistencies. So what I published on Friday is completely unsupportable in factual terms. But I will tell you that the reason that I came to these conclusions was I had a bit of a revelation last week, and I let it I got too excited about it, and I really started to get I think thinking about the yield curve spread and all the argument that you have about it. Because every single time that it becomes inverted, people argue that this time is going to be different. And then it never is different. There's always a recession. And I started to think about, well, why is it always the case? What happens in terms of tightening of liquidity conditions? And I came to the conclusion that we're talking about it the wrong way around. It's not that the yield curve spread is a lead indicator for future recessions. It's that an inverted yield curve creates recessions. And if we think about it like that, I think it starts making a lot more sense. In terms of economics, recessions are sort of anomalous events, difficult to really put your finger on as to exactly what is happening. But when we start to really think about what do you need for economic expansion? What do you need for stock markets to do well? What do you need for asset prices to appreciate? Well, it comes down to the very simple conclusion that you need more money. And you need an incentive. So there has to be money around for people to invest. And then there has to be something for them to put it into in order to generate a return. So then, of course, central banks, they dictate what that market rate is. Now, we can have an academic argument about whether it is right and proper that a small number of people get to set the interest rate for the whole world. And shouldn't it really be a market setting mechanism? But that's ethereal, whereas the reality is that central banks set the interest rate. And for a good long period between 2009 and 2021, the interest rate was exceptionally low. So if you are running a bond portfolio and you're compounding your coupons, you're compounding interest, you're reinvesting your coupons, then when interest rates are almost zero, and we can think about just the 12-month yield, and by simply looking at 12-month yield, you already get your annualized rate. So between 2020 and 21, it was almost zero. And for a long time, between 2009 and 2015, it was close to zero. So if you're running a bond portfolio and you need guaranteed returns somewhere in the region of about 8%, and they've shaved it down over the last few years to 7%, how on earth are you going to be able to make that money if you're getting nothing in terms of return of yield from your portfolio? Because all of the performance in the bond market was price appreciation. So we can look at the price of bonds. Now, obviously, we get big coupon changes this year, and that's going to create a very choppy chart. But over the period from 2000 all the way through to 2020, we can see that on aggregate, prices went up. And they most especially went up during the periods where we had zero interest rates. So there's no coupon changes in those charts because there weren't any big coupons. Well, what it then tells us is that during periods of exceptionally low interest rates, then money has to flow somewhere. And it goes into bonds on a momentum basis because there's no interest rate anymore, so everything behaves like a zero coupon bond. And the price appreciation sent yields negative because there's no duration in the portfolio anymore. So it means that your future cash flows are discounted. So the entire financial market, whether it is equities or bonds, focuses on discounted cash flows. And if you're a bond investor, you're discounting cash flows in the future, and you're comparing that against an inflation rate. And if you're in the equity market, you're discounting cash flows from dividends from the future, and you're comparing it to the discount rate. And the interest rate and the discount rate are basically the same thing. So when there is no interest rate, then those long duration assets do really well. So we saw that we had a huge quantity of bonds that were negative in yield. And that was back in early 2021. There was $18 trillion of bonds with a negative yield. And today it is 1.3 trillion. And a good portion of that are going to be longer dated Japanese bonds. Or at least a good portion of those are Japanese bonds. Now, when we start to think then about what's next, well, we've seen that interest rates have jumped higher. So we had this huge momentum move in fixed income during the low interest rate period between 2014 and 2021. There was huge quantities of bonds went into negative yielding territory. And if you are then comparing an equity investment against whatever that bond rate is, whatever the risk-free rate is, and the yield is negative, well, then you're making nothing on your bonds. You're entirely dependent on momentum to drive that trend. And the higher the price goes with low interest rates, then the more susceptible those prices become to a hike in interest rates, which is exactly what we've seen this year. But at the same side, or I guess the same argument applies to companies that don't have reliable cash flows. So companies that did exceptionally well during the pandemic, they have collapsed this year. And they've collapsed for a good reason. It's because interest rates have gone up, and they're exceptionally sensitive to interest rate hikes because of the exact same reason that all those bonds had negative yields and now have positive yields. It's because the longer the duration of the asset, the more sensitive it becomes to interest rates. So the ARK Innovation ETF had peaked at the beginning of 2021, massive reaction against the prevailing trend, period of right-hand extension, and then broke lower at the beginning, or really at the end of last year, and is struggling to put in a base formation right now. So this has been the direct response to rising interest rates. Now I want to come back and think then about the yield curve spread. So, when we have a wide spread, it means that the up here at the peaks, back in 92 and in 2003, and between 2000 and really 9 and 11, we had a spread in excess of 250 basis points. So the long end is 250 basis points higher than the short end. So if you're a bank, you can borrow at the short end, you can lend at the long end, and you pick up the spread. And then you can do that with leverage, and you can pick up even more. And I think that's the most important thing to remind ourselves about in the financial markets. There is no good idea that is not leveraged, because that is basically the job of the financial industry. It's to come up with good ideas and then find a way to absolutely max out the potential return from that idea. And that's exactly what we had with the negative yielding bonds. And it's also exactly what we had with the very highly priced, unprofitable companies. It's also why the FANG companies did so well. If you wanted to outperform the market for the last decade, all you had to do was own those eight companies. The more of them you owned, the better your portfolio did. And what happened was it created this self-feeding trend, because ETFs are market cap weighted. So the larger the market cap of the instrument, then the more likely it is to dominate the market cap index. The ETFs are based upon, and I don't know why I'm not getting that chart to come up. The bigger the investments that occur in ETFs, then the more it pushes up those prices. So just like we've seen this trend of bonds with negative yields, the companies that did best, those that were best positioned to benefit from this phenomenal wave of free money and had the wherewithal to expand globally, then they've done exceptionally well. And between 2013 and 2021, the largest companies in the world, or at least what became the largest companies in the world, went up over six times. So, and let's just put an actual number on that. It's more like 1.7. So they went up almost 12 times. So that's a phenomenally large advance. And this trend looks like it is over. Now, we are overextended relative to the 200-day moving average. Right now. So there's the potential for some steadier action, and we're getting some steadier action. But the other point here is that these were companies that benefited enormously from low interest rates, and not simply because they were the ones that were benefiting directly, but also that they were providing services to companies that were also benefiting. So one of the reasons why we've had so many startups over the last few years, obviously there's the trend of technological innovation, which has been swift. But it's also easier to be a startup now. You don't have to hire a bunch of engineers to develop your own in-house server farm. You don't have to concern yourself with all of that infrastructure, because you can outsource it. You can go to Amazon or Google or Microsoft and simply leverage up immediately by using their web services divisions and their server farms. And basically you put everything on the cloud. So that's one of the reasons why these companies did well, is because not only were they deploying free money to their own benefit, but they were facilitating that other companies would also be able to put free money to best effect as well. So this is what happens at the upper side of the range. You get lots of liquidity and lending becoming available. Now, it's easy to think that during this bull market that we didn't have banks lending, and we didn't. The recalibration of the banking sector has taken a long time, and they got out of some of the most risky portions of the market, particularly in North America. And the European banking sector is still dealing with its the portfolio of non-performing loans. But into that gap stepped private money. So we have a large number of private lenders that have been created over the course of the last decade. And the mortgage sector in the USA is now dominated by non-bank lenders. So you have Rocket Mortgage, for example, that is a non-bank lender. Then you can think about the fact that in terms of risk-taking behavior and making markets, well, banks like, for example, Goldman, they decided they were going to make themselves into a bank rather than an investment bank. And that was a way of curtailing some of their risk. And into that gap stepped Citadel Securities. So now that's a big privately held market-making operation that took over a big piece of business that some of the banks gave up during the financial crisis. So during this period where the yield curve spread came down from 2011 through to 2019, then that was really a transition where banks got back to banking and risk-taking behavior moved into the private markets. And privately held companies don't have to report as stringently as public companies. They're more like traditional partnerships. And we've seen that business model really predominate over the last decade because lots of free money and markets with exceptionally long durations and this enormous momentum move in both bonds and in the tech sector, they're exactly the same trend. But then we saw the pandemic, and that represented this enormous flood of new money. So if we look at the money supply over the last decade, it was bubbling around between really between about 2 and 10% between 1998 and 2019. And then during the pandemic, it went as high as 27 point, well, let's just call it 27%. And now we're back down to one. So the economy is still expanding, and money supply growth is expanding slower than economic growth. So in fact, money supply growth is contracting. And there's the real possibility that it is going to come all the way down to zero, because now the Federal Reserve is worried about inflation. And inflation is really the enemy of long duration assets. And it forces investors way down into the shortest possible durations, because they're the fixed income securities that are least sensitive to interest rates. So that's important because it's siphoning money out of risky assets and forcing investors to park that money in less risky assets. And that's basically what the inverted yield curve is. So it is pulling money out of speculative ventures. And now the big question, of course, is going to be, well, when will the Federal Reserve start to cut interest rates? And when will we start to see more new money flowing out into the economy? Well, the dollar index is breaking lower, and that is on the back of the Federal Reserve saying that they are probably going to hike rates less than they have been doing So this isn't even in response to them saying they're going to stop raising interest rates, or it's not even in response to them saying that they're going to start cutting interest rates. The dollar is breaking downwards simply because they are easing back from the pace of hiking. So this is a very meaningful event. If the dollar remains weak, it's going to make commodity prices stronger. It's going to make the imports into the US more expensive. And that's inflationary. So, how can the US then come to a point where they're going to cut interest rates if the dollar is already declining like this? Because there's no real appetite for fiscal consolidation. And one of the big points about the advance in 2011 through to 2015, it wasn't so much about rising interest rates. It was about the Tea Party and balanced budget initiatives and trying to get the government to stop spending money. So we're nowhere near that kind of event right now. And the dollar is breaking down in a meaningful fashion. And the cost of servicing the national debt is up to over $550 billion a year. So we can certainly think about the fact that there's an awful lot of debt. And now inflation is starting to pick up. And then there is the big question. How is inflation going to come back down? Well, there are going to be supply and there are going to be demand factors. But I think the most important thing is that an inverted yield curve will create a recession because it will pull that money out of long-dated assets. It will park it in short-dated assets. And then we'll see leveraged plays to try and enhance the attraction of cash. So, inflationary pressures are likely to moderate. The CPI has already rolled over, so it isn't coming down fast. But it is coming down, and we're down to about 7.7% right now. But wage growth is still rising. And here's one of the big wrinkles in the whole inflation question. So, CPI is starting to come back down, but there's still a shortage of workers. So, how do you solve the shortage of workers problem? If you want to try and get in control of inflation and you have a population that is flush with cash or is willing to spend, and credit card use is certainly trending higher, then if you need more workers, you can do two things. Well, first is you can import more workers. Now, the USA has historically done a good job of that, both legally and illegally, or at least both within the rules and outside the rules. There are millions of people walking over the border in the southern border, and they don't tend to get counted in official statistics. But when you start importing several million young people, then that is going to affect your percentage youth in the population over time because they will be absorbed eventually. But when you start thinking about higher skilled people or people who can work in the formal economy, well, then there's an acute shortage of those. There are millions of elderly or, well, people over 55 years old that are choosing early retirement, and there's a dearth of people available to fill their positions. And historically, the USA has relied on importing highly educated people and looking for certainly the Indian imports have Indian imports of people have filled out the EB1 visas for years. So you get very skilled workers coming in on what are effectively temporary visas. But The USA has foregone 6 million of those since 2016. So there's a shortage of workers. Now, if you're not willing to turn around and start importing more people and becoming a lot more attractive, or a lot more incentivized to boost immigration, then you basically have to either automate your way out of trouble, which is certainly not easy. Japan has been trying that for years. Or you shrink your economy down to a level where you don't need as many workers. And it's obviously not something that anyone likes talking about, but that's what recessions do. They contract the economy. And suddenly, a lot of the enthusiasm about hiring people disappears. So it's quite likely that that is exactly what's going to happen, that the longer interest rates stay high. And if we can simply look at it really is an exaggerated fact that the difference now between the 10-year and the 3-month is at negative 76 basis points. Now, this was really quite sharply inverted in 2019, and I was very much of the view back then that we were due a recession and that the clock was ticking. I didn't anticipate in 2019 that we were going to have a global pandemic, but I was at an investment conference where I met people that were trying to invest in private equity and didn't know the first thing about it. So, this is, I think back then that was a perspective that things were getting a bit too hot. But then we had the pandemic and we had this massive swell of new money. And I do think that that is similar to what happened after the long-term capital management crisis. If we go back and look at the NASDAQ over the period from 1996 through to 2001. So in 1998, there was the wobble. And the response to long-term capital management was to flood the market with liquidity. And interest rates stopped going up for a little while. And then they started going up again in 1999. And the market peaked in March of 2000. But we can also then, I think, contrast that with how Amazon performed. And what I find especially interesting is that forget about how it's doing right now, and instead look at the fact that Amazon peaked really in April of 1999. It got all the way up to the peak in December of 99 and didn't hold it. By the time the market peaked in March, the price had already pulled back by, well, not quite a half, but not far off it either. And then subsequently, we had the big crash in technology shares, and then in 2001, there was 9/11. So we had a mild recession then, but the technology sector really was decimated. And it really helped to highlight the fact that at the time, it was really only the technology sector that was in a bubbly environment. Whereas today, we have exceptionally high valuations in property, and it's a global phenomenon. We have still got very high prices for bonds. If we just simply look at a bond future, the price is at 114. Well, if we look at just bond futures generally, almost all the prices are above 100. So, what that tells us, at least, is there's been a lot of demand. Now, it's not like bond prices have always traded above 100. And if we look at the Bund future over the long term, well, it was at 220 a year ago. But prices have been trending higher for a very long time. And back in the 1990s, they were trading a lot closer to 50. And it took really quite a while. Really, it was the Big Bang into the euro, or the creation of the euro, that got them to price around par. And since then, there's been this epic advance in prices. So we've had a bubble in bonds, and because of those exceptionally low yields, we've had incredible appetite for debt, and that debt has been concentrated within the property market. So the stock market is a big asset class. The bond market is a much bigger asset class. And then property is far and away the largest asset class. And Chinese property is the largest of the fixing of the property asset classes, and nominal value is somewhere around 60 trillion. So when we start to think then about the difference, I think it is very clear that at this phenomenal move we've had in technology is in direct comparison with the big move we've also had in bonds. And that makes sense, that when borrowing costs go down, investors find somewhere to put their cash. Well, a lot of people would put it into property. And now we're starting to see that Blackstone is limiting the redemptions from some of its property funds. And they really did very well. So we had a move up from 9 and change in 2020 to 14, or almost 15 right now. So a really significant advance in terms of pricing. And then income hasn't been forthcoming for most of the last, well, more than a year. And now they're limiting withdrawals. And a lot of those withdrawals have come from Asia. Well, it makes sense why those withdrawals would come from Asia, because the dollar's going down. So it's fine if you're willing to take risk in US property. And it looks great if the dollar is strong. Then you're being compensated with capital appreciation and with the yield and with the currency. When the currency rolls over, well, then it makes everything else pale in comparison. So that's basically what's happening right now. And this falling dollar is something that is going to start raising important questions. Most particularly, it's going to raise the question of the sustainability of the dollar as a reserve currency. Because what we've definitely seen over the last 2 years has been the established world order using its institutional might to exert influence on other countries. Now, we can again argue as much as we want about whether that is the right decision or not. But if you're sitting in Russia or China or Iran or Saudi Arabia, and you're looking at the fact that the US government didn't like what you've just done, and they've cut you out of the SWIFT system, then you might think that it just makes sense to have an alternative. So the thing is that you get to have the reserve currency, provided you let everybody have equal access to it. And your currency almost becomes a non-national entity. But then we can think too about what Europe is doing with trying to put a cap on Russian oil. What they're trying to do is limit the price that oil can trade above. And the mechanism they're using to do it is insurance. So most of the global reinsurance market is with the Lloyd's group of companies in Europe or in London. So they have the heft to move around the insurance markets, and they can force the shipping companies basically not to use Russian oil. And that, I think, is obviously going to create issues. It greatly enhances the potential that there's going to be a significant accident in the shipping sector at some point in the next decade. Simply because some companies will simply go without insurance, and that reduces the incentive to keep up with at their scheduled maintenance on ships. And these ships definitely need constant maintenance. Now, oil prices have pulled back from a peak of 140 and are trading back around 85. And prices are still in a downtrend. Now, I have a lot of people telling me that prices are going to accelerate higher. And I have to think about, well, how could that happen? Well, the first could be that China opens up and that muted demand growth from China suddenly reappears and prices ramp higher. And that's possible. If China continues to open up and they slowly but surely unwind COVID zero and consumers get back to doing what co consumers do, that could certainly help to inflate demand for oil. But the reality at the moment is that prices are continuing to trend lower. And OPEC Plus, most notably, does not include the USA. And the USA is now a major energy exporter. So that is putting the major energy producers and the USA on a collision course. And Saudi Arabia is increasingly siding with its largest customers, which is China. So we're seeing a really significant change in the world order. But then we can think about the fact that we've had a long period where investors were holding US reserves and they were willing to increase those reserves because the dollar was the reserve currency. And by increasing the reserves, it was creating demand for US bonds. Well, if investors around the world are less confident that the USA will maintain the global order or will maintain equanimous access to resources and international bodies, then why would you hold US dollars? That pretty much suggests that gold will continue to advance. And gold popped on the upside last week, and it is back now to test the $1,800 area. Now, that's obviously a psychological level, but far more important than that is the downtrend has been broken. So, I don't think that gold is capable of rallying in a very big way in the teeth of a recession. But it's certainly something that will hold its value. And occasionally there will be these bigger declines which provide buying opportunities. We've just had one. And I do think that the dollar has further to go on the downside. I think the USA is going to find itself in a tough position. They're going to have to figure out how do they support the dollar and also meet their debt obligations and also avoid a chronic recession. Now, I think one of the biggest consensuses in the market right now is that we're going to have a mild recession. I think lots of investors have been willing to think that a recession was inevitable. But what happens if it's not a mild recession? What happens if we get a deep recession? Because I look around where I live, property prices on around the periphery of Dallas are down 20% since March. Now, a 20% decline in property prices is a lot at any time, but in the space of 8 months, it is a really graphic representation of just how interest rate sensitive prices were. And anyone who bought in 2020 or 2021 or the first few months of 2022 are now in negative equity. Is this creating a new buying opportunity for first-time buyers that houses are suddenly becoming a bit more affordable? Well, only to the extent that they don't have to get a mortgage because mortgage rates have doubled. So basically, prices are now clearly responding to higher rates. Then let's think about countries that completely avoided a decline during the global financial crisis. So the Australian dollar is now testing resistance at the region of the 200-day moving average. Prices in Australian property are at eye-watering levels relative to income. So the very low interest rate environment was a clear move into property for a lot of Australian consumers. Now interest rates are rising and inflation, wage inflation has not taken off in Australia yet, but certainly imported inflation has been problematic. Now the RBA is raising rates. They said they weren't going to until 2024. They apologized for that this week, and now they're raising rates. And the Australian dollar is testing the first area of potential resistance. So it's really more of a dollar bear story than a big Australian dollar bull story. And property prices in New Zealand having accelerated higher during the pandemic are now also rolling over. And the big argument that's been used for property in Hong Kong for years is that many people don't have mortgages. So it doesn't matter what happens in terms of price, that it's only a very small sliver of the market that actually trades. And that's true. But there's an exodus of people out of Hong Kong. And everyone got a taste of what living under an authoritarian regime feels like during the pandemic, and a good many people are deciding that it's not for them. So, what's actually happened in the UK over the last year is that this was a record year for immigration, with special visas given to people from Hong Kong and Afghanistan and the Ukraine. One thing I did notice in London 2 weeks ago. Was or last week was that a number of I would say half of the Uber drivers that I talked to were from Afghanistan, and that's usually a good indication that that's a job that people will take up as soon as they land in a country and have uncertain prospects. They'll start driving taxis, and Ubers are the new taxis. So the UK, despite the fact that immigration is not exactly popular, has welcomed more people than ever in the last 12 months. And you need more new people. Now, obviously, decisions need to be made about what kind of people need to be brought in and how to supplement the higher skilled portion of the economy in order to drive productivity. But those are decisions that absolutely need to be made and discussions that need to be had. And there's really not a lot of coherent discussion going on about it in many countries. So I'm going to come back then and think about, well, if long duration assets haven't been doing well, what about the shorter duration assets? So the energy sector is holding on, and the S&P 500 is back above its 200-day moving average. Now it hasn't broken the sequence of lower rally highs yet, but it's at least testing them. And the Dow Jones Industrials Average has broken the sequence of lower rally highs, and it was at a new recovery high last week and held on to most of the advance. So the defining characteristic of industrials are blue chip companies is the visibility on their cash flows. So we've definitely seen that some companies have seen their valuations contract meaningfully. So Pfizer has an estimated PE of 7. BMW has a PE of 3. Then let's think about companies like Ford. So has an estimated PE of 7. These companies yield around 4%, which is give or, and some of them yield substantially more than that, which is competitive with prevailing interest rates and even competitive with inflationary pressures, particularly if the price goes up. So obviously then the question is not so much whether these represent value, because on just an objective basis, a yield that low with a PE that low with a yield that high, it already suggests that there's a problem somewhere. So we know what the problem is for the automotive sector. They have to go off and completely redesign their businesses, and they have to think about what they're going to do with all their workers. What are they going to do with all their suppliers? All those companies that were building engines and parts for engines. The Biden administration is attempting to force electric vehicles to be 50% of the automotive fleet by 2030. Now, I don't think that that's possible, but it doesn't mean they're not going to try. I think they are certainly going to try. So I think these are important factors. And the big question then is, what happens to earnings? So earnings have done really well. If we just take one company, and we know how we know how difficult it has been in terms of the production of vehicles. So revenue fell during the pandemic. The number of cars being produced fell during the pandemic, and it started to recover in 2021. And it's probably did a bit better in 2022. But that's been during a period where monetary accommodation has been really rather extraordinary. And now we know that money supply growth is falling. The central banks around the world are raising interest rates. You have the ECB. In Europe, talking about really starting to pay attention to their central mandate, which is to control inflation, and they're not doing that very well. And they don't have a lot of tools available at their disposal. It's not like they can suddenly create more oil, and it's not like they can suddenly turn back the clock and make the workforce younger. The problem, of course, is that the workforce at the older age bracket has cash, and the younger people don't. And this is the big issue that needs to also be addressed, that older people that are moving into retirement now have significant resources. They have money in their home, and they can cash out of part of the appreciation in their home. Or they have portfolios that have appreciated significantly in value, or they have these fat pensions that have been promised and are now being paid from years of service. So it's helping to support consumption at levels that are above what would be normal. But ultimately, pensioners generally consume less. They don't have to pay back mortgages any longer, and they don't have to pay for school fees. And as people get older, then their appetites change as well. So I think it is quite likely that what's going to happen over the next year or 18 months is that liquidity conditions are going to continue to bite. Now let's think about the anatomy of a bear market. So first they raise interest rates, and that takes a lump out of the most leveraged, well, excuse me, the most interest rate sensitive portion of the market. So that's what's happened in the last year. We've seen bonds at the long end collapsing in value. We've seen the ARK Innovation ETF rolling over, and all those highly valued, profitless companies rolling over and pulling back exceptionally sharply. Then we get the inverted yield curve. And the inverted yield curve acts with a significant lag. So initially, investors tend to celebrate because finally central banks are starting to act against inflation. And asset prices tend to go up. And that's almost exactly what we're seeing right now. Asset prices are starting to recover, and that's really par for the course in terms of liquidity, the response to this tightening, the initial stages of the tightening liquidity. But then it also puts pressure on levered investors. And we've seen several levered investors running into trouble. So the first levered investors running into trouble were the Chinese property developers. Their entire business model is completely dependent on access to new liquidity. So several of them went bust. There have been several defaults. And now the Chinese government has announced that they're going to provide almost $1 trillion in terms of supports for the property sector and the property developer sector. Course, there's also $2 trillion of local government debt that's going to roll over next year. And they really do need an active property sector to soak up all of that additional liquidity. And that's not at all a guarantee. So we're going to see a lot more money printing coming out of China over the course of the next 12 months. But ultimately, liquidity conditions are starting to tighten everywhere. So Credit Suisse had the, I'm not going to pronounce this correctly. I actually rebel at pronouncing it correctly because I think it really is Arch Egos that saw huge levered bets. And now the company has declined significantly, and they've been funding some really egregious risk-taking by some of their clients in the prime brokerage. So that's contributed to a real mess for the bank, and it's another example of a clear liquidity situation. Then we can think about UK government bonds. Well, it's created a hole in the UK pension system that's approximately 100 to £150 billion. And the response has been really silent to the fact that pensions aren't supposed to be engaged in leverage, but they did it anyway. And they did it because interest rates were so low and they had to do something to try and improve their yields. And now, because of rising interest rates, they were caught short. They didn't have the liquidity available to meet margin requirements. So there was a big short covering rally. And that's another example of a major liquidity issue. And then FTX, the crypto exchange going bust, and several other crypto exchanges on the brink of bankruptcy or already having gone bust. That's also about liquidity. They found that they were simply incapable of responding to the volatility in the market and did not have ready resources to meet capital calls. So again, another example of liquidity crises. And this is also really representative of the second iteration or evolution of a bear market. And then eventually, because the yield curve spread stays inverted for a long time, and we talked about this at the chart seminar. There was one of the delegates was saying that his wife is a senior bank, or she's a senior law partner, and the primary business they do is writing the documentation for loans. And what has happened over the last 6 months is she's got nothing to do, and she's coming home early every day, which is something that they've never seen. And she's worried about her business because there's nobody borrowing money. Now, that might be because there's nobody borrowing money. It might also be because the banks don't want to lend. And with and of course, there's a give and take. When interest rates rise, then investors are looking at how much further they'll rise and where the value is. If you're a borrower, Well, you might want to lock in rates when they're low, but you don't want to borrow as much when rates go up. And when you have an inverted yield curve, well then banks don't want to lend because they're not going to make as much money. So there is a push and pull which contracts liquidity globally. Then we saw the liquidity event that happened in South Korea, where the market convention is for issuers of perpetual debt to buy them back at the first call, and then they refused to do that. And they opted instead to pay the higher coupon. And then, if you were the person who bought that bond, well, you were expecting your principal back on the given date, and then it didn't happen. So your liquidity situation suddenly becomes worse as well. So we're seeing lots of examples right now of liquidity issues. But we have not yet seen earnings roll over. And this is why I think it is important to highlight that companies like Pfizer, which benefited enormously from the pandemic, or Volkswagen or GM, where they have these really low yields, excuse me, really low PEs and higher yields, it's because investors are worried about demand. And oil prices are hovering around $85 and have been trending downwards for most of the last year because of demand. So, what we have in the future, the final stage of the evolution of the bear market as a result of the inverted yield curve, is lower earnings. We're going to start to see earnings declining. So, an earnings recession is inevitable. But it's an earnings recession will then help to contribute to rising unemployment. Now, when property prices are falling, but you have high employment, well, then you don't have a debt servicing issue. But when people start losing their jobs, then that's when you start to see debt servicing issues appear. So, those are the kinds of issues that are in the future. Now, I then think about the kinds of assets that are doing well right now. When we're faced with all of these issues, I think what investors are starting to look at is where are the guarantees? Well, we know, for example, that the Inflation Reduction Act in the USA is hundreds of billions of dollars for the renewable energy sector. Now, that's going to be spent one way or another. So the solar sector is starting to do better. Then we can think about the sort of the nascent battery sector. Companies like ESS Tech have pulled all the way back down to their lows, and they produce these iron flow batteries. And I listened to their quarterly earnings call last night. So they're getting new customers, and they've just started production. They've got 10 batteries out there in the wild. Four of them are generating income. They estimate they'll have 20 out in the field by the end of the year. And I guess the call was in November, so that's really only a month away. And they're still dealing with legacy contracts, people they gave really favorable deals to because they wanted to get the business off the ground. And they're looking at selling their batteries for about 190,000 each. But these are the kinds of batteries that will sit in place for decades. And they provide backup power for anything up to about 9 to 12 hours, but mostly about 4. So they get twinned with solar installations, or they get twinned with wind installations. It's the only way that these renewable and intermittent sources of supply are going to be able to reach base load capacity and provide security of supply for whoever uses them. And I think these types of different kinds of batteries are inevitable, and most particularly because they don't use lithium and they don't use copper. So we'll have different kinds of batteries for different kinds of different kinds of utilities. And These are the kinds of companies where there's a visibility on future cash flows. That it's not simply that, I mean, they talk about having a pipeline of 9 billion, and it's against income this year of 1.5 million. So it's not like these kinds of companies are going to shoot higher when we have high interest rates and inflation and everyone's worried about the state of the economy. But when things do start to turn around, then there will be companies that have positions that will benefit because there are short-term themes and there are long-term themes. In the short term, the fact that we have global liquidity tightening, we're heading into what is potentially a global recession and potentially a deep global recession. That's the short term. And when I think about the short term, I think about the next year. Over the medium term, we're seeing these environmental meetings every year now, and they head off the governments of the world head off to some location and make big promises, and they make new big promises every year. Now, I really think that there is very little chance that voters are going to be okay with sending billions overseas to build up the renewable energy ventures in foreign countries when there is money that has to be spent on health services at home. But it does represent an opportunity for companies because the other big issue that came out of the COP26 meeting was that carbon prices should be more like 135 euro. So they're at A7 right now. They've been quite choppy over the last year, but this was a big move on the upside. I kind of think of carbon credits like bonds, and that, but they're like zero coupon bonds. So they're not going to, you're not going to be getting your coupon, but you're going to get capital appreciation. And it's government sponsored because carbon credits aren't going to go to zero. It's a politically created market. And when prices fall, they reduce the quantity. And there are stated political objectives to get higher prices. Back in 2020 and 2019, they said they wanted prices at 100, and prices are at 100. Now they're saying they want prices at about 135. Prices are going to get to 135. It's going to greatly increase the cost of carbon in Europe. We're more likely to have a global carbon trading network. And carbon will probably become a globally fungible commodity in just the same way that natural gas is now becoming a globally fungible commodity. As we think about how do we come out of this impending recession, well, I think that really is the very big question. Are we now in a new environment? Or are we going to repeat the mistakes made over the course of the last 12 years? Well, I do think that central banks have been sufficiently chastened that they can't simply ignore inflationary risks, and now they have an inflationary problem that they have to deal with. So I don't think interest rates are going to stay low indefinitely, and I think that they will rise and liquidity will be withdrawn faster on the next occasion. And I kind of think that's what the inconsistency in Bitcoin is telling us. So there were big key consistency characteristics in Bitcoin. And one of them was that it never pulled back below a previous peak. And now it has definitely done that. And the other big consistency characteristic is that anyone who's ever held Bitcoin for 4 years has never lost money. Well, the price right now is at 16,700. So, well, 4 years ago, was somewhere a lot lower, nearly $10,000 lower than where we are right now. And we are about 15, 16 months away from the next halving. So it would be reasonable if the If the cycle is true or is still in play, we'll see a low in prices at some point in the middle of next year. And I think that will probably also coincide. It might not happen on the same day, but it will coincide with the beginning of pricing in of easier monetary policy. Then you get the halvening in April of 2024. And then subsequently, it's reasonable to anticipate that if the cycle is still in play and central banks do exactly what they have been doing, then we'll see a multiplication factor in prices. And that would basically mean that at the period of quantitative tightening that's underway right now will result in the same kind of surge higher that we saw in 2020. And that in response to a global recession, the size of the Fed's balance sheet will approach 20 trillion. And that's assuming that's the pattern of activity that's prevailed since 2009 remains intact. But Bitcoin's price is a lot less consistent than it was. So does raise the question too as to whether this pattern of behavior will be sustained. And I don't think, well, I guess I'll put it in the positive. I do think that central banks are going to flood the market with liquidity when they start getting afraid of deflation. And a deflationary shock is coming because earnings are going to fall as liquidity remains tight. And eventually, we're going to see unemployment rising because companies are going to start experiencing pressure as all of this liquidity gets siphoned out of the market. So, 10-year yields are still contracting. And I suspect that we're going to see the 10-year yield collapse to about 2%. And probably by the middle of next year. And it's going to be in response to a significant deflationary shock. And that deflation isn't simply going to be that inflation rolls over, but rather that it's going to be because property prices are coming down and people are going to be in negative equity. And then we're going to see perhaps a big call back to the office. And people are going to say, well, we're not going to support remote work anymore. Or there'll be something like that that will be a shock to the property sector. And then we'll see interest rates starting to come back down. The Federal Reserve is basically saying that they want to hold interest rates at high levels for a reasonably prolonged period. And if we go back and look at history, that generally means anything from about 3 to 6 months. So then we can see, for example, that one of the longer periods was in 2006, where interest rates were held from May 2006 all the way through until August of 2007. And that inverted yield curve scenario with a long period of higher rates and tightening liquidity contributed to a really significant problem. Well, I don't think that the problem right now is in necessarily in the property sector because there isn't a lot of new supply. But the price has been, the problem has been in the price appreciation and affordability. So prices would have to come back down to where they become affordable once more. But the bigger issue is in the private markets and endowments, pensions, charities, where they've been investing massively in private assets and they don't have to write them down all that often. They're not marked to market. But at the end of this year, there will be a revaluation. There will be annual reports written. Now, some of those are going to be at the end of the calendar year and some of them are going to be at the end of the fiscal year. But it suggests that at some point in the next 4 months, there's going to have to be a writing down of some of these private assets. And I think the easiest way to monitor this is through Brookfield Asset Management's share price, because it's trending downwards. It's encountering resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average, and it has not pushed up through it. And this has been by far the most successful of the big property investors. They own commercial properties everywhere in all the major cities, and the occupancy rates at some of these buildings are exceptionally low. I was chatting with one of the guys on my tennis team on Wednesday, and he owns or he runs a mutual fund, and he was saying that the building that they're in, which is would be considered a sort of a prestigious building, half their workers now work from home. Their president had been commuting nearly an hour and a half a day to be in the office, and found that he could work fine from home, and basically told the office that he's not going to be in unless there is a really pressing meeting. And they're subletting out their offices. And rather than thinking about, well, these are companies that are contracting, and their business is doing fine, and they've been accumulating assets because they didn't have a big weighting in the FANGs. So their performance was a bit better this year. What's happened then is that they're subletting out their offices, and it's family offices moving into the area are buying it. But family offices, they have by and large been investing in private assets as well. So I do think that there's a reckoning coming, that these liquidity issues are real, they are growing, and economies are going to slow down, and corporate earnings are going to become less reliable, and that we are going to go into a recession in 2023. And then subsequently, we will get new liquidity provided. And we are going to see the kinds of assets that have implicit guarantees implied or inherent to their businesses that will do well. So it's either going to be those that benefit from massive support from governments. And we can definitely see that, broadly speaking, the industrial sector, not the especially the Dow Jones Industrials, which has companies like Apple and Microsoft and Visa. But I'm thinking more of hard, big stuff that doesn't break easy kind of industrials. And Caterpillar, Deere, they've all rebounded really impressively. And there's then the national security issue. So companies like Lithium Americas, and exceptionally volatile share, the 20 to 40 range over the course of the last year. But they're building the Thacker. Well, they're not building it yet. They've got all the permissions to build the Thacker Pass lithium project in Nevada. That's the biggest lithium resource in North America and one of the biggest in the world. And they're demerging the company. So next year they're going to have two entities, and one will be a wholly US entity, and then they're going to ask the government to build a mine for them. So they estimate that they could have 10x margins based upon the cost and size of extracting the lithium. But that's of course assuming they get to build the mine. And until they break ground, then investors are still going to be leery of these kinds of companies. And of course, people are still going to need energy. They're still going to need the basics of life. And then the question, of course, will be how are those things going to be paid for? And are we going to start to see prices coming back down? So Costco has been a darling of the investment universe. But that was an awfully big downward dynamic last week. And we had this another downside key reversal. So To me, at least, this is suggesting that consumer demand is ebbing and that we are going to see a deeper pullback. There's been a lot of enthusiasm for the rebound over the course of the last 6 weeks. A lot of it has been to do with desperation among investors to really rescue their performance over the last year. And we might also think of it as a Santa Claus rally. But I think that the other really significant thing is that the dollar has rolled over, and that's going to burnish the reputation of emerging markets. And we can think about the Nifty index, and this is in US dollars, and in local currency, it is at a new high. India has 600 million people under the age of 25. Indonesia has a large young population. Nigeria has a large young population. The one thing we know is that most of them have phones already, and they're on the internet. And they don't, we might have argued 20 years ago that they aspire to the lifestyle that we take for granted. But the reality is that now they can see what our lifestyle is via social media and the internet, and that's what they aspire to. And governments have to move quickly to provide people with a route to that kind of improving standard of living, or governments will fall. Well, India is pretty far along in that. And most of the world has a real vested interest in seeing India succeed because it would be a counterweight to China in the Asian region. And they do, after all, share a border, although it is on top of a mountain. So India is likely to be a major beneficiary. The other, I think, very significant issue for India is that its property cycle stands outside the rest of the world. They went through a really significant property downdraft about 4 years ago. And lots of the housing finance companies went bust. And if we just simply look at Yes Bank, it is still trading, but it's trading at a fraction of where it was trading in 2018. So there's a new credit cycle underway in India, and it's helping to support prices coming off of depressed levels. Now, that's very different from what we see everywhere else, and it is the basis for a new bull market in Indian equities. Over the last week, I've been talking about a new acronym, which would be Mexico, India, and Indonesia and Nigeria. Well, Ian Little wrote to me over the weekend, and he said, "Well, maybe perhaps you should name it Mini, MINI. Wouldn't that be better for smaller international markets?" And of course, that is correct. I was slow to change because I really wanted to think about Ethiopia. So I was always thinking about mine, but Ethiopia doesn't have a stock market that one can easily invest in. So I dropped it from the acronym and I held on to the mine. But Mini works just as well. In a weaker dollar environment, emerging markets become much more attractive. One of the biggest challenges for emerging markets over the course of the last decade has been the strength of the dollar. And then that has made funding dollar debt way more expensive. Well, a weaker dollar takes that problem away, and it makes it much more accommodative to source dollar funding. So then emerging markets tend to do well. And money is getting pulled out of America. That's also what the redemptions from Blackstone's property sector or funds also suggest, that money is being withdrawn from the US markets and it's finding a home elsewhere. Then let's think about the UK, where the pound has rebounded really quite impressively. So we had the huge acceleration on the downside following the ill-timed Quarteng budget. And now with a new budget, the price has basically recouped all of the loss. But now the pound is pushing back up into the overhead range. And the UK is adopting fiscal constraint. Now they haven't cut spending yet, but they are certainly raising taxes. And there are plans underway to rebalance the nation's finances. And that's being rewarded by the currency markets. And it's going to make UK, it's going to help to bring down UK inflation by strengthening the currency. But it's also going to enhance the international reputation of the UK. That doesn't look. That's not something anyone is really talking about in the media right now, because everyone's worried about the energy crisis. But taking measures that are responsible in terms of the national finances, that will be rewarded over time. Now, obviously, we're not yet through this recession, and there is still a difficult time ahead, but the FTSE 250 is hovering here in the region of the 200-day moving average. Now, it's going to have to break the downtrend to really confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. But I do think that UK valuations have contracted enough that any kind of meaningful change in the global economic environment is going to be beneficial. But the problem in the short term is that just about everyone in the UK owns property. And many people own several properties. And many people's pension has basically been focused upon rental properties. And property prices in the UK are exceptionally interest rate sensitive. And there's a lot of those fixes are going to roll off next year. So we are not going to avoid a recession. There will be a recession. And there will be issues with servicing debt. And ultimately, that's going to result in more liquidity being made available. And that's a phenomenon that's going to happen everywhere. So we already know what the monetary response will be. The only real question is how long that extra liquidity will be left in the market when central bankers have just been through this visceral experience of inflation. What it suggests to me is that we are going to be in a lengthier period of higher rates, and we're not going to go back to the zero interest rate environment. And we still have this issue where older people have cash and are not working. So we have a really big hole in the productivity of the economy where there just aren't enough people. And that's going to continue to put upward pressure on wages. And it's and one thing that has also been very much at the back of my mind. When Joe Biden met Xi Jinping in Bali a few weeks ago, in Singapore, you had Li Keqiang and Henry Kissinger speaking at a conference in Singapore. Now, Henry Kissinger is a century old, and Li Keqiang is in his late 80s or 90s. So, within the next decade, we're going to get a huge generational shift in power. And a lot of the people, and let's just then also highlight the fact that in the USA, Joe Biden is 80 years old. Donald Trump is in his late 70s. So if they run against each other, it's probably going to be the last hurrah for elderly people, because the next candidates are going to be perhaps 30 or even 40 years their juniors. And that's a huge generational shift. It would suggest that taxes on pensions are something that will happen in the next decade, because the voting numbers of people will change. So when we think about all of those buy-to-let properties, they've done fantastically well. But then the question, of course, will be how are they going to be treated for taxation in future? And how much rent control is going to be voted for? And will rental properties continue to offer the kind of benefits to investors when we see a political change and a generational shift in rule setting? I think these are big long-term considerations and certainly worth paying attention to, because when we look at the size of the asset inflation we've had over the last decade, last 30 years, and especially the last 18 months, then trying to recalibrate that is going to be a very big issue. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you, and apologize once more for losing the run of myself. And really, I do sincerely apologize for not taking the time to test my own conclusions against rationality. But I really did allow myself to become overexcited at the conclusion that yield curve inversions are not just lead indicators, but actually cause recessions.